It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferrat.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, it's our weekly look at Congress with USA Today politics editor Paul Singer.
First, Wisconsinites headed to the polls yesterday to vote in a variety of primary elections. The winners will head to the general elections in November.
By and large, the results came back as expected, but there was a surprise or two.
Here with us to break down the results is Mordecai Lee, professor of governmental affairs at UW-Milwaukee. Mordecai, welcome back.
Hi, Rob. Thanks for inviting me.
Well, one of the races we thought we wouldn't have to talk about too much looked like it was a done deal. The GOP primary in the 6th Congressional District, it was called for candidate Glenn Grothman, then uncalled. What's going on there?
Well, you know, sometimes we have expectations about precision of vote counting that really aren't quite as reasonable, because it's an old, almost 19th century process where they have to hand count the absentee ballots, they have to call it into the clerk has to write it down. You know, I'm trying to get everybody to visualize that this is a very old-fashioned process. So the fact that on election night we got the results very slowly, and then that his lead started diminishing is, I think, just a reflection of how antiquated our election results reporting process is.
Well, this has happened in a past Supreme Court election where the winner kind of flipped and flopped a little bit as we saw different areas coming in over the course of days.
Rob, I'm glad you're mentioning it, because this is a problem across the board. It's not a problem for Democrats or Republicans or Fox Valley versus Waukesha County. Well, we really do have an antiquated infrastructure.
Do we have a sense of when we're going to know if it's Glenn Grothman or Joe Lipum in that district?
I think what's going to happen is that because it's so close, there's going to be a recount. And whether it's close enough, so it's an automatic recount, in other words, within 0.5%, or whether it's slightly beyond it, I'm pretty sure one of the two candidates will do it. And I once participated in a recount, and I can tell you it's a very slow process, but it's a very exacting process and a very reassuring one in terms of trust in government. They really do literally do it one at a time. And so I wouldn't be surprised if the lead changes or if the lead narrows. You know, some of your listeners might remember the recount up in Minnesota that Al Franken eventually won by, 23 votes, and they argued over every single one. So I think it's going to be a couple of weeks.
Well, turning to a county sheriff race. Now, county sheriff races don't usually get a lot of attention outside the borders of a county, sometimes not that much inside the borders of a county. Where you are now, the Milwaukee County Sheriff race got national attention. Why did it draw so much?
You know, it's so surprising. You remember when during the April election, the Koch brothers sided with and opposed some of the county board members up in, I think it was Douglas County or something like that, and people were saying, huh? You know, why is a national organization getting involved in a county board race? Well, the exact same thing happened here in Milwaukee County, and the reason I'm mentioning that earlier example is I think what we're seeing is the nationalizing of local elections. In other words, all of a sudden, every election, even for dog catcher, becomes a kind of a referendum on the partisan gridlock and the ideological gridlock in American politics. And so the sheriff of Milwaukee County is actually the least important sheriff in all the 72 counties in Wisconsin, because Milwaukee County is the only county that doesn't have any unincorporated areas. And that means that the sheriff here has no sort of police department kind of activities. So he does the freeways, and he does county facilities and bailiffs, and that's about it. But even though he's so minor in terms of policy, his views on gun control and on right versus left political ideology made this a kind of a referendum. And so it was an interesting race to watch, even though it seems to me, in terms of policy, a very unimportant one.
Right. The incumbent ended up winning there. Lots of money came in from the NRA, from Mayor Bloomberg's group opposed to or in favor of gun control. This is a seat that will have almost no say on gun control decisions.
You know, it's just astonishing how ideology can make an unimportant office seem important in terms of elections. And in fact, I'd go one step further. Why do we elect sheriffs? We don't elect police chiefs. But this is sort of another example of an antiquated 19th century habit that's carried over into the 21st.
Well, probably the most high-profile primary in statewide races was the attorney general race. We saw Jefferson County District Attorney Susan Happ win over Dane County DA Ishmael Ozan and State Representative John Richards. a race where all three candidates were really, really similar in their positions on almost all issues. What do you think gave Susan Happ the edge there?
You know, this is an astonishing result. And in fact, you could almost say this is why we still hold elections. In other words, for all the pundits and for all the commentators who in advance predict elections, this one was totally unpredictable. And, you know, thank goodness for the Wisconsin voters for reminding us of that. And she really, I'd have to say, came out of nowhere and had such a commanding victory. It's just awesome in that respect. And another thing that I like about it, Rob, is that she was not necessarily the highest spender. You know, sometimes we start getting a bit lazy and we start thinking that the biggest spender in a contested election is always the winner. No, that's not always the case, and she's a good example of it. And you know, there were some minor policy differences between her and the other two Democratic candidates, for example, on gun control, on first offense for drunk driving. But I think here it was almost like a spontaneous conference call by the Democratic voters in the primary who said, let's all coalesce behind her. And I think she's a fresh face, a new face, and I think this is good for the voters because it means that the November election between her and the Republican nominee is going to be a real election with two very competent and qualified candidates.
Moving on to the other big statewide race, the race for state treasurer, before we get to the governor's race now. But it's interesting in that we talked to all the candidates here. We ended up with a Democrat who wants to restore duties to the office, a Republican who wants to get rid of the office completely.
You know, I think this is healthy because, in a sense, even though this is a minor office, there's a clear-cut choice. Voters who think it should stay in elected office get to vote for one of the candidates, and voters who think it should be abolished get to vote for the other. And I'll confess that I'm biased here. When I was in politics so long ago, I introduced a constitutional amendment to abolish both the state treasurer and the secretary of state's office. It's almost like my comment about sheriffs. Why do we still do this? But it's very, very hard to abolish elected offices.
All right. Now let's get to what a lot of people are seeing as the main event here, the race for governor. Briefly, the primary, Democrat Mary Burke cruised by a substantial margin past Brett Halsey. Was this ever really in doubt?
I don't think this was in doubt, and this was probably, from the perspective of the Burke campaign, a kind of a shakedown cruise or a dry run to see how good their organization is. And if judging by the results, even though he ran a minor campaign, they're in pretty good shape, and the Democratic voters are behind her. I was a little surprised that she did not hold a kind of a victory party down in the Milwaukee or Madison area, so she could get on TV and get sort of the momentum one gets from winning a primary, no matter how sort of unimportant it was. After all, Governor Walker last night, having no primary, did a victory party and had a speech on TV. He got to give his message out to a million voters. So I was a bit perplexed by the political logic of her being up near Rhinelander and not being in the main media markets.
Well, the race has already in effect been Burke versus Walker. Now it truly is. Recently, national political pundit Larry Sabato from the University of Virginia called this one of the five most competitive races involving a sitting governor in the country. Headline news, the primary results in some papers. Mordecai, what are you going to be watching for in the coming months in this race?
I think what I'd suggest we all watch for is who successfully defines the race. When we heard Governor Walker's victory speech last night, he was trying to define her. Will she be able to get out from under that? Will she be able to define the race as, let's say, a referendum on his promise of 250,000 jobs? That, I think, is going to be the result. And she's been pretty disciplined about not getting into ideological fights on emotional social issues. She's almost running as though her qualifications are, I'm not Scott Walker. And so we'll see who can prevail in this sort of public debate, who can be more persuasive. And here, money will make a difference. If he outspends her 2-1, that means we'll be seeing two commercials for every one she has.
Well, there's a lot of people in the state who'd vote for Darth Vader if he was on the right ticket. What about that handful of undecided voters? How do they reach out to them?
Rob, I really love it that you're mentioning it because there are about 6 to 8% of of voters, likely voters, who claim that they're undecided in the governor's race. Now this is sort of an astonishing phenomenon. How could somebody not have an opinion about what's been happening since Act 10? You know, you wonder if they're off the grid, if they're living in the Stone Age. But you're right to focus on it, because if the race right now is 46-46 or 47-47, those 6 or 8% will determine the election. And I think what we're seeing is that both campaigns are sort of fishing for what will be the magnet that will attract these voters, what will budge them off of being in the middle of the road and undecided. And to a certain extent, that's the election. The secret to the undecided is the secret to winning the November election.
We'll be watching that between now and November. Mordecai, thanks for joining us again.
Thanks, Rob.
That's Mordecai Lee, professor of governmental affairs at UW-Milwaukee. It's time now for our weekly look inside Congress with USA Today politics editor Paul Singer. The U.S. military is back in action in Iraq, but how are the country's legislators responding?
And there were a few surprises in yesterday's primaries, but coming up next Tuesday, there's a primary in Alaska that'll play a role in deciding which party controls the Senate next year.
And while the Senate may be in play, a USA Today report out earlier this week lays out plenty of reasons that the House is pretty securely in Republican hands this fall. USA Today politics editor Paul Singer joins us every week at this time. Paul, welcome back.
Thanks a lot, Rob. How you doing?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm doing great, thanks.
Well, Congress seems to be pretty solidly in support of the airstrikes, at least the airstrikes, against ISIS in Iraq. Is it fair to say that Congress is actually more or less in agreement on something?
Maybe a little bit. It's what's interesting about the statements out of Congress is that they agree that the airstrikes are the right thing to do, and that's all they agree on, because there's sort of several schools of thought. There is the Republican camp that will tell you the airstrikes were the right thing to do, but it shouldn't have come to this if Obama had not withdrawn troops from Iraq. There's another camp that says the airstrikes are the right thing to do, but we need to do much more. We need to send more ground troops and really take back over the country. There's another group of Republicans that would tell you that the airstrikes are the right thing to do for humanitarian purposes, but we cannot under any circumstances get more American troops involved in Iraq. And then, of course, there's Democrats who say basically the same thing, that airstrikes were the right thing to do, but no open-ended military commitment is possible. We can't be involved in restarting the Iraq war. So, yes, I think there is broad agreement that this was a humanitarian crisis, that the United States needed to respond, and a military response was appropriate. Once you get past that, the disagreements break out into the open.
Do you expect to see any sort of cohesive positions developing anytime soon among Democrats and Republicans?
No. You know, what's interesting about that is that, first of all, Congress, of course, out of session, so they don't have much to do on this topic for a while. And the second thing is, it's not clear that Congress has any real authority to do anything anyhow. It's fairly clear that the administration has an authorization for military force in Iraq that continues to permit them to use military force without the approval of Congress, particularly if there's no ground troops involved. At the moment, the administration says they don't need any more money, so they don't need Congress to approve that either. So there's nothing really forcing Congress to take action or to come to a consensus position. And honestly, I think to some degree Congress would prefer to stay out of this. I don't think members of Congress have a good answer either, and so they're better off letting Obama struggle with this problem rather than inserting themselves into the middle of it.
So since they won't be directly involved out of session, maybe they don't need to do anything. Is this going to give at least some members of Congress some latitude for electioneering around this issue?
Well, maybe, but again, it's hard to decide how this cuts, right? If you are a conservative Republican, you're running in a campaign, you can say, "See, Obama screwed up in Iraq." However, if it looks like we are running a successful humanitarian operation, rescuing tens of thousands of Yazidis from a isolated mountaintop where they face sheer starvation, maybe Obama looks good. at that moment. You know, it's hard to figure out exactly what the political angle is here. I think, you know, the strongest political angle, honestly, is possibly the least popular one, which is there's a small group of liberals who are arguing no more war, get out of Iraq, no more bombing, let's walk away from it. Possibly also a small group of kind of isolationists on the conservative side as well. Maybe they argue this is a good campaign piece for them because they can say, you know, we're the ones who really are for peace. But I'm not sure that's going to move a whole lot of races.
And meanwhile, as you said, you've got President Obama sort of acting alone on the world stage.
Yeah.
If, say, things go spectacularly well, just, you know, for the sake of argument.
What are the odds of that?
is there any chance he could turn it into political capital and use it to swing some Democrats in the November elections?
Well, you know, I think any time there is a U.S. engagement in the world and the president is leading on the world stage, to the degree it works out well for the Americans, for American foreign policy, that, of course, makes the president and his party look good. And people will want to stand next to the president, or at least next to the president's policies, and say, this is what we did right. In this case, however, I have to say, without being sarcastic at all, it is hard to understand what exactly the good outcome would be that would make people want to stand there and say, we achieved something great in Iraq. It's very murky. Even a victory at this point, it's not clear what a victory is. I mean, the whole campaign is about freeing these people who are in jeopardy and you know, to some degree degrading the ability of ISIS to move across the nation. But, you know, that's a pretty narrow goal, and I'm not sure it's one you put on a campaign platform.
Well, moving on to primary elections, just had ours in Wisconsin. You told us last week, Paul, not a lot you're watching here in terms of control over Congress or the Senate, and, well, obviously not the Senate, no election here. But looking ahead, what races are you keeping an eye on in the next week or so?
Well, I do want to mention, though, I was eavesdropping on your conversation with Mordechai Lee, and that was really interesting when he talks about the fact that like 6 or 7% are the undecideds in the middle. When you think about that, mm-hmm. and it matters for this conversation about who controls the Senate, you know, in a lot of these races, we are talking about the swing races, we're talking about, you know, 45 to 45. Republican to Democrat, they both have, you know, no one has a major lead, they're neck and neck. It means that in the middle there are these 5 or 6 or 7% of people who are in theory, or in some ways, the least politically active and the least politically engaged. They don't really have strong opinions about politics. They're the ones who are going to make the decisions. It's really interesting when you think about it that way. The one I'm watching now is Alaska. We actually got a reporter going up there in a couple of days. There is an Alaska Senate race. Senator Mark Begich is a Democrat up for re-election. Alaska is a tough place for Democrats, always has been. And there was a Republican primary yesterday. Republican primary next Tuesday. And there is, again, this divide. There are a couple of candidates in the mix for Republicans, one a Tea Party candidate who is pretty divisive, one a sort of more establishment Republican who's being attacked by the Tea Party guys for being not from Alaska or not a, you know, real Alaskan. The Republicans are in danger of eating their own young here, having a brutal primary, and leaving Begich with a clearer path to re-election. That race could be one that really determines the tilt of the Senate in November.
So the Senate is in play, but USA Today published a report earlier this week saying that the House is pretty much a done deal in terms of going to the Republicans.
That's right.
How come?
Part of it is redistricting. At this point, members of the House have basically chosen their voters instead of the other way around. So there's very few districts that have any kind of swing in them. They're built to be safe Democratic and safe Republican districts. And then you've got, you know, 90-some-odd percent of the Congress are incumbents running in safe districts. There's about two dozen House seats that are really competitive, and in those cases, most of them are Democratic-held seats. There's only a handful of Republican-held seats that the Democrats really have a chance to win. So we say there is no way they can get the 17-seat swing they need to take over the House of Representatives.
All right, we'll leave it there for now. Paul, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks. Have a great week, guys.
You too. That's Paul Singer. He's politics and Congress editor at USA Today. He joins us each week at this time to bring us up to date on the latest from Congress and in election season, what's going on in the primaries and then the runoffs.
Back-to-school season is almost upon us, and with the start of another school year, millions of child athletes from around the United States are preparing for a new sports season. But with 1.24 million sports-related trips to the emergency room for students in 2013, there's a lingering question about the safety of school sports.
A new report out today from the group Safe Kids Worldwide finds what they call an alarming gap in what's known about sports safety and what's being done to reduce the risk of injury to young athletes.
We're joined now by Kate Carr. She's the president and CEO of Safe Kids Worldwide. Kate, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks so much for having me on today.
So with your new report, Changing the Culture of Youth Sports, what did you set out to investigate with it?
Well, as you pointed out, the large number of kids, over a million, who were seen in an emergency room for injuries related to the 14 commonly played sports really prompted us to take a look at what's happening on the field, what do we know from parents, coaches, and kids. And we interviewed over 1,000 of each, and we had some very surprising findings.
It's an interesting line to walk because you want kids to be active. It's a way to combat obesity in America. And on the other hand, there is a lot that we still aren't handling as well as we could when it comes to injuries. What did you find out in your report?
Well, we found out some things. And the first thing I want to say is we want kids to play sports. Sports teach you teamwork. They instill great values in kids, and they keep them active. And that's especially important when we look at the nature of our obesity epidemic in the United States. So playing sports is great. Playing them safely is something that we could do perhaps a bit better. We heard that 42% of the young athletes that we interviewed told us that they would downplay or even hide an injury so that they could stay in the game. They don't want to be benched. They want to be there for the team. And that puts them at risk of even a more serious injury, whether it's a concussion or a sprain that gets aggravated or worse knee injuries. It's a good thing for kids to be able to speak up honestly and openly about their injuries and to have them evaluate it.
And what else did you find? What are some of the other, you know, common injuries and things that are happening to cause injuries on the field?
Well, when it comes to what's happening on the field, 1 in 4 of our young athletes reported that they thought it was okay, it was normal to commit a hard foul or to play rough, to send a message during the game. And that norm is leading to a large number of injuries. 33% of the athletes also report that they had been hurt as a result of something that we would call dirty play, something that shouldn't be happening on the field. It goes beyond the boundaries of the rules. So looking at what attitudes are about those hard hits or those late hits, we can change those attitudes so that the games can still be played and competitively, but played safer.
It sounds like kids were saying, you know, they're used to the culture of sending a message with a hard hit like that. So that's some of the culture you're looking to address.
It's definitely culture. And when it comes to culture, we talked to parents and we talked to coaches. And coaches told us that they felt a great deal of pressure from parents or players to put an athlete who's been injured back into the game, even against their own wishes. And that kind of pressure, again, something we can change.
Now, you also looked at just how knowledgeable the coaches themselves were about how to handle injuries and the difference between that reality and what parents perceived. What did you find there?
Well, the thing that was very surprising to me, 1 in 4 coaches said that they didn't take any specific actions to prevent sports injuries. And I was thinking, not even a stretch, not even hydration, water? Maybe our question was not worded in a way that they got something really simple still counts as prevention. But we also found that over 90% of parents thought that the coaches were well educated in injury prevention, and yet over 50% of the coaches reported to us that they wanted more injury prevention, more certification in something that right now there isn't a common consistent certification program for injury. You might have concussion prevention. You certainly have CPR. You might have some basic emergency, you know, here are things you do under an emergency situation, but injury prevention really needs, we need to look and see, do we need a certification course? And Safe Kids thinks we do.
How old were the student athletes that you talked to?
We talked to kids who were in 7th through 10th grade. And there was a reason for that. Kids who are between the ages of 13 and 15 account for 37% of sports-related emergency room visits among kids we looked at between 10 and 19.
10 and 19. So it's a pretty broad age range, starting pretty young to see some of these problems cropping up. And you also address another trend that we're seeing that you see in your report, and that is student athletes zeroing in on one sport really early on to excel at it and then maybe burning out or getting injured. Can you talk about that?
Well, there's a lot of concern today about the specialization in sports and how specialization in one particular sport can lead to overuse injuries. We know that kids come to the field with dreams of being absolutely spectacular, and we want to encourage those dreams. But one of the best ways that we can encourage that dream is to say, don't just do one sport. Diversify your interests so that you develop other muscles, you hone other skills, and it will make you a better athlete. It will also give your body some time to rest and recover from that arm that you might be pitching 12 months or 11 months of the year. Take a break from the one that you love. You won't get burnout, and you probably won't abuse your body.
Is that a hard message to sell when you look at stories like Tiger Woods, where you see toddlers out there playing tennis and they become, you know, champions later in life?
Well, for some of those champions, we see them burning out at a very early age, and we certainly see athletes who have been injured and who suffer the consequences of some serious injuries that sideline them from the sport that they love. You know, we are evidence-based, so we look at the data that's out there, and the overuse injuries are increasing, and it is connected, we believe, to the specialization in sports. So this is a message, I think, that we can all embrace. For everyone who is just drilling down on that one sport, we probably can find 10 examples where they do something else. It's the football or baseball player who goes out and plays golf. And, you know, it's out there. And professional athletes who we've talked to have told us that they value that diversification. And that's a message we're trying to pass on to parents and to kids.
Well, let's talk about some of the solutions. What do Safe Kids think should be done now that you've uncovered some of these trends and problems?
If I had my dream, I would say, especially now as back to school equals back to sports for a lot of kids and a lot of families, start this next season with a conversation on the field or on the court between coaches, parents, and kids, and set the ground rules. We don't have to have legislation that limits contacts or rules. We can actually start with a conversation and agree these are the things that we're going to do, things that can prevent overuse injuries, ways that we can encourage athletes to speak up when they're injured, and also ways to teach athletes about preventing injuries, and finally, the focus on those hits that don't have to happen, the late hits, the dirty play, put an end to that. That can be a sort of a ground rule that even that little league team can agree on. You don't have to wait for a law to be passed or to be in high school or college to have that agreement among the players.
How much of a role do you see parents taking here, especially in this initial conversation between coaches and athletes and parents?
Well, as a parent, and I'm the parent of an 18-year-old now who's going to be a high school senior and plays three sports at the varsity level, parents tend to be involved in their kids' sports. From the earliest days when we're out on the soccer fields, when kids are just learning and when they're 3 and 4 years old and they're learning the rules of the game, we can be involved, whether we're involved as a parent coach, a parent volunteer, or a parent shuttling their kids back and forth. Parents play a role in their kids' future and their lives. And so becoming educated about simple things that can be done to prevent injuries so that your child can grow up safe and strong and play the sports that they love. That's the message we're trying to get out.
Let's take a call here. We've got Nadine on the line with us from Appleton. Hi, Nadine.
Hi. I had a couple of comments, although really your guest has probably said it all the best, but just from firsthand experience, I live in an area that is becoming more and more sports-oriented all the time, And the one thing that has disturbed me as a past coach over the years is seeing what I'm calling easy money makers. These are centers that are promoted all summer long, especially in our local magazines for children's activities, for example, that are really capitalizing on children in the concept that they need to train, keep training, and compared to younger and younger kids with some pretty hefty training and the repetitive throwing, kicking, uphill joggers, lifting. And I just feel there's just something unhealthy seeming to me about these centers and the advertising I'm seeing and where I visited, really not staffed with people who have the medical knowledge of these bodies and what they should and shouldn't be doing. The other comment I would have is being a past coach and more on the football side of the spectrum is the dirty plays. And knowing that I went through concussion training, plenty of training to be a coach for these kids, you know the kids count on you. There's a lot of dirty playing going on. And the problem lies with the adults, and the problem also lies with the coaches. And as a coach, just feeling a huge amount of pressure, not just from parents on the sideline, but other coaches or assistants standing by saying, oh, don't call that out or don't bother that coach. It's an older coach. You're a new coach. When your children are coming up to you crying with abdominal hits, or hit to the rib cage, or hit to head that were intentionally caused by another player on the opposing team.
All right, let's leave it there. A lot to chew on in Nadine's call, talking about sports training centers being pushed and keeping kids active and whether or not that's healthy. And then also the sort of culture of, you know, being afraid to speak up when you see stuff with coaches. What do you think?
Well, we certainly know that kids are still continuing to grow, and even, you know, a brain is not fully formed, they say, until you're 25. So you're in a process where you're growing, you're going through lots of body changes. Kids need some time to rest as well. And so that constant push may not be in the best long-term interest of the child. It might fill a need that is even driven by a child or driven by an adult, but you need to have adequate rest day to day and a break from the sports that you love. That's a message that we like to get out there. And in terms of the element of dirty play is, you know, we'd love it if that could be one big culture change, because we think that would drive down many of the injuries that happen on the field that are so unnecessary and can be very serious, and serious enough to merit a trip to the emergency room. And that gets to be an expense for families and for communities.
We're talking with child safety advocate Kate Carr about the culture of youth sports, and you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. We're talking now with Kate Carr from the group Safe Kids Worldwide about the culture of youth sports and their new report that showed there's ground to be gained in terms of keeping kids safe during the school year and school sports season.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you're the parent of a child athlete, what concerns do you have? Anything you want to see changed in youth sports culture? Also love to hear from coaches as well. Call in at 800-642-1234 with your questions and your experiences. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we go to our phones right now and take Dino in Middleton. Hi, Dino.
Hi, Veronica. Thank you very much for a wonderful show.
Oh,
I just had a comment from the perspective of coaches, particularly at high school football level, where success on the field in terms of winning is rewarded with continued employment. High school coaches don't have very large populations from which to draw upon. They don't get to pick and choose the most athletic individuals in high school. They have to basically put a team on the field with who's interested in playing. And sometimes that leads to rosters and positions where children or kids can be undersized or not as quick. So they have to motivate these kids and push them to, you know, extend their performance. And sometimes this translates into a style of play that should be more aggressive than it needs to be. I just wanted to get your thoughts and feelings from your expert on what things coaches experience as far as job security and pushing their children to really play beyond their abilities.
All right. Well, thanks a lot for that thought, Dino. Interesting take there that coaches' jobs are on the line and it might benefit them from a career standpoint to push their kids past where they should go. Is that a perspective that you looked at?
We didn't really look at the coaches' livelihood as part of the study. Our study was focused on injury prevention and how we could talk to parents, coaches, and kids about keeping kids safer. So we know the coaches play a really important role, and they have to motivate kids. And they use various tools to motivate them. One thing we did look at is coaches yelling at kids. And I've certainly seen games where that happens. And, you know, but there are also times when that message that's delivered at a high decibel might make a child not want to play the game. So there are things for coaches to mull on, but I'm sorry I can't respond to your question about their livelihood and their economic opportunities.
Are you working at all against the mythology of sports? I mean, I've probably seen a dozen movies where the coach really lays into the players. Maybe the players go out with an injury to win the championship. In Karate Kid, you know, he's basically got a broken leg and he goes out there anyway and he's a hero. Are we working against, you know, what people love about sports?
Well, playing with a broken leg is probably, you know, the glorifying that works against the message, because that injury can be compounded. And, you know, well, let's talk about it from the perspective of a concussion, which isn't as visible as a broken leg. A head injury that is serious enough to cause a concussion puts your brain is trying to heal, and if you sustain a second hit that causes a second concussion, you can have devastating consequences from that second blow that can lead to paralysis, and in some cases it's even led to death. So we're not making this up. This is serious, and it's very hard to evaluate that. So the culture of being able to go out there to win one for the team and play when you're injured is definitely something that we think we ought to take a very hard look at and say, what are we doing to that child? What pressure are we putting on that child to win a game? And is that game more important than a lifetime of being able to play that sport?
That's a big cultural shift. That's a big cultural shift you're talking about. How do you get athletes and parents to buy in?
I think we have to get people talking about it, and that's the purpose of our report. We've been working with support from Johnson & Johnson for years now on this issue of how do we talk about keeping kids safe when they're playing sports. Keep them playing, but keep them safe. And it does involve a culture shift, because we know that the number of injuries is going up and up and up. And there's an impact. And some parents are on the other side, where they're so concerned that they're not putting their children into contact sports. And we're not trying to limit sports. We're trying to make them safer.
We're going to go back to our phone lines now, and you can join us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. How do you make sure that your children are safe when they play? Do you think that there are enough safety measures out there to keep your child safe? And would you be willing to trade anything off if you got safety back? Brian is next in Port Washington. Hi, Brian.
Good afternoon, and thank you for having this show. I will tell you, I had a son who just graduated as a senior and played football since probably the fifth grade. And the desire to play football each year got more complicated and stressful for him each summer, as the pressure to do year-round weightlifting, summer lifting, and camps continued. So much so that going into his senior year, it was tragic that he even thought this way. He thought he just didn't want to do it, and told one of the coaches he wasn't going to do it. And the coach said, look, skip all the camps this summer. It won't hurt. The head coach pressured them all to come and do the summer lifting in the camps. And he came back, had a great time, had an opportunity to start about half of the year. But it was because the one coach, his position coach, came to him personally and just said, look, just ignore all the pressure. Come back. We'll have fun. And it was a great senior year, so it's a very timely subject. I'm glad you're talking about it. In his case, it worked out good, but some kids just completely quit going into the senior year to avoid the pressure.
All right. Well, thanks a lot for sharing that story, Brian. And Brian talking about the importance of taking a break for his son. What do you think, Kate?
I think it's a great story, Brian, and thank you for sharing it, because who doesn't want to see their child have that last great season, but be able to have fun? You know, that's what sports should be about, the ability to go out there and to have fun and to be active and to be able to walk off the field without a serious injury. And that's a wonderful opportunity. And that pressure, you know, that pressure comes for seniors at the same time that they're feeling enormous pressure about what are they going to do next in their life. Is there an opportunity to go to college? What career are they going to pursue? I empathize with you, since I have a senior this year, and so I know what that pressure is about. So great for that coach that stepped up and said, let's find the way for you to continue to play sports. And that's where we applaud coaches who have an understanding of the athlete that they're working with and an ability to work with them to help them through what might be a hard time and to also keep them safe and engaged.
Well, Kate, thank you so much for joining us today. Appreciate your time.
Great to be here. Thanks so much for having me on.
We've been speaking with Kate Carr. She's the president and CEO of Safe Kids Worldwide. And we've been talking about her new report, taking a look at back to school equals back to sports and what that means when it comes to keeping student athletes safe and the changes that may need to happen. You can keep the conversation on U Sports going on the Central Time Facebook page.